Express yourself. Express yourself. You don't never need help from nobody else. All you got to do now, express yourself. Whatever you do, do it good. Whatever you do, 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 Lord, Lord, do it good. All right. It's not what you look like when you're doing what you're doing. It's what you're doing when you're doing what you look like you're doing. Express yourself. Express yourself.
Well, howdy, everybody. It's Friday again. And you're joined here with Brian and Amy in the studio.
I'm here.
Amy's here, too. It's Express Yourself, the weekly exploration into everything creative happening up and down the Roaring Fork Valley. And to start things off, I am joined here, and let's see if I can pull this off, by Kelly and Kyle Phelps on Zoom. How are you guys?
Good, good, good. And you? Thanks.
Great. Let's see. Thanks so much for joining. And Kelly and Kyle are here because they are part of an exhibition. So you can see me. Part of an exhibition at the Clay Center right now here in Carbondale. And the title is Race, Class, and the Blue Collar. It just opened last week, and it runs through basically the end of August. And I'll just do a little intro for you guys, if you don't mind, and we can dive in. Kelly and Kyle Phelps are professors at private Catholic universities in Ohio. Kelly Phelps is a professor at Xavier University in Cincinnati, where he oversees the sculpture department. Kyle is a professor at the University of Dayton in Dayton, where he is the head of the sculpture department there. And welcome. Thanks so much for taking time, you guys.
Thanks.
I wanted to just talk a bit about your work in the show, what it's about. I know the title kind of helps with that, Race, Class, and the Blue Collar. But for anyone who hasn't seen your work in person before, I wonder if, since it's a radio show, if you could just describe it visually for folks out there.
Well, our work is primarily about our experiences growing up living in a Rust Belt factory community in the Midwest. A lot of automotive industry, foundries, abandoned warehouses, a lot of factories that have just been shut down. Mm-hmm. And what Kyle and I like to do is we like to kind of pay homage to that and, you know, collect remnants from the cast off factories that have been shut down, and to kind of memorialize the art. So the work is kind of like, if you look at them, they're almost like altars or shrines to the individual workers. So
our work is very figurative and very narrative storytelling. So mm-hmm. we combine like old, anything that's found objects related back from the factories and combine it with our handcrafted ceramic work or figurative work.
Yeah, I really feel the kind of the human touch looking at your work. I haven't been to see the show in person, but the photos from the Clay Center's website, you can really see the passion you guys have for those that media, first of all the clay media, but also the subject matter of the blue collar working class, race relations, like common struggles of humanity. And then can you talk about like how you get these found objects? It sounds like you're going to like the scrap yards maybe, or the things like smell, they give off this odor of like the oil from the scrap metal. And how did you come up with that idea?
Well, we wanted to have something more than just a ceramic element, a figure or a figurine. Mm-hmm. So we struggled with this all throughout our education. Even through graduate school, we were really we were full of ourselves because we liked to do the figures, but we didn't have any context. We didn't have a
real connection.
A connection back to the figurine. An example is that we had a critique in the Louisville local Louisville paper, and they great article until you get to the very bottom of the article, and it said the twins' work was much like Hummel figurines, and that was like the
death knell in the coffin.
Yeah, it was us a lesson. So we wanted to be as authentic as possible, and that's why we go to these factory sites. And even if it's just a cast off gear or an old glove or the old metal lunchbox, something that came from the site,
because gives a sense of place and time,
further off authenticity to the work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it kind of makes it real.
We do go to these warehouses and we go to these factory sites and we retrieve. And a lot of people think, oh, we're just scrapping for aluminum or copper or stripping wire out. But we're after those everyday objects.
Mm-hmm. And then crafting these amazing like fine art pieces that talk about that experience, and also, you know, your experience too is coming into that. Can you talk about how you got into clay and also like your just experience growing up and how you kind of came up with this style?
Well, so growing up in the Rust Belt, I mean, the Rust Belt really isn't the mecca for fine art. So in the community that we lived in, if your dad worked in the plant, you most likely were going to work in the plant. So it was that factor mentality.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those things where if you did have art, the art would have been that turkey that you drew on construction paper.
And, oh, sure.
You made that holiday type of art. But what we were interested in is that we were interested in the fact that all of our people, and not just talk about African-American people, the people down the street, you know, white and black people who worked on the lines, that was our subject matter. Mm-hmm. And that all that was there all of that time as we were growing up. I don't know if we just rejected it or
didn't recognize it
at the time, but those were our working class heroes in real life. So our mother, our fathers, our sisters, and people who worked on the plant, black or white, I mean, it didn't matter to us. It's just the fact that they were working class people. So art, that was what we wanted to do is to really kind of pay homage to, because you don't see people, everyday people, you know, who works in the steel mill. There's no public sculpture. There's not a lot of that about everyday people who works at the gas station or the woman who turns back the linen on the hotel beds that we stayed in. So, I mean, it's just everyday common people that were really interested.
And people that we tend to kind of, you know, take for granted, invisible workers. You know, we don't think twice about the people that are producing, you know, everything that we need in this world. So it's just giving them, you know, their respect.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some amazing pieces with, you know, firemen and, that kind of like really hardworking people that you, like you said, can be invisible unless, you know, you're in the middle of a fire perhaps, and they come to your rescue. And that's a really great way to kind of pay homage and bring attention to that.
And as Americans, I mean, we're really into the consumer part of it. We like to see the end product, but it's rare that you actually see the people who actually make these products who probably often can't even afford those objects. So it's important for us to kind of put a face on those invisible people.
Yeah, that's interesting, because in today's world, it seems like, you know, everything's about technology, you know, for the higher class people, I would say, but there's still people like making that happen, like on the ground, right? So that's cool that you guys are bringing attention to that. Can you talk about a little bit about your process, how you make the works?
The process is, we're like a dysfunctional marriage. You're getting the complete sanitized version right now, because we work in a really tight studio, a really tiny studio at that. So we're like really up in each other's personal spaces. So there's a whole lot of, you have to be okay with that. I mean, as siblings for one, but identical twins who have strong personalities, the act of collaborating is really easy for us, but to outsiders, you think, oh my God, I would be pulling my hair out. Our process typically starts out with a lot of research.
We take a lot of photographs of factories, carry a sketchbook, or we'll do a lot of reading. Every day there's a new factory that's coming down, and it sucks because it doesn't even make the front page of the newspaper anymore. It's like second nature. I mean, so we usually start out collecting our resources and our reference imagery, and then we go back to the studio and we start in clay, and we start sculpting the clay. And once we get the figure, then we go back to those found objects, then we marry those found objects with the particular figure to create the narrative that we desire.
Wow. I really got to go oversee that show, but it's up through the end of August, and it looks like you also have a workshop coming up towards the end of the show. Can you talk about what that is about?
To give you a little bit of kind of an idea of how we work. So we're going to have some in-process work. I mean, it's only a day workshop. So it's just kind of a sped up the way that we start off rough and refine our figures and talk about surface treatments, how we paint.
But more importantly, we get into how we generate the ideals of our figure and the narrative. So the we're actively storytelling. So a lot of people struggle with, well, where do I start? And sometimes that imagery is it's already in front of you. Like us living in a working class community, all of that imagery was right there in front of us. We didn't have to recreate the wheel, but we struggled with it until you open your eyes and see that, wow, there's beauty in some of these everyday things. So we're going to talk about the process of just generating the ideals.
That's a great way to connect with people, you know, across all classes and all races. You know, there's always that story and that narrative, no matter your background. So that's fascinating. Let's see. Anything else you want people to know about your show?
Even though it's about the blue collar, the work is really, I think it transcends. I mean, we've taken our work up north, and it's about obviously the blue collar and the steel industry. We take our work down south, and it's about the textile mills and the oil industry refinery. We take it to out to the southeast. It's about coal. And so work is work, and it's universal. And we like to really make it known that our work is about working class people. It's not so much about, you know, it's not Afrocentric. I mean, a lot of people have that expectation, oh, two giant black guys making clay figures and kind of have Africa connection. I think the fact that it's about work, and work touches everyone's life in some way. I mean,
we do also touch on other subjects,
social, political current events, like what's going on with Black Lives Matter, you know, civil unrest that's going on in the United States. All of that is intertwined with class. You can't separate race and class. I mean, so we like to kind of combine all of those things because one affects the other. When there's unemployment, I mean, there's social unrest. I mean, there's a lot of things that interconnect.
Yeah, we found that out a lot over the past year. Just, you know, the things that are kind of in your face, but you don't address until it kind of comes out in a big way. I wonder if you could just briefly, before we go, since you're brothers, how does it work when you're working together on a project? I mean, I have a sibling too, but
a lot of arguing.
So neither one of us are the author of any one piece. It's not a Kyle piece, and this is a Kelly piece. We're kind of like, since we had that opportunity of working alongside our father in the plant, we learned that work ethic, that factory assembly line. And whatever we do, it's for the betterment of the piece that we're working on.
So we had the thing that we kind of deemed as a subconscious okay to work on each other's work. And I can work on something, pass it on to Kelly, or he'll just step over and change things. And like I said, it's for the betterment of that particular piece that we're working on. But at any time, we're working on three or four pieces at any time. And we just kind of rotate back and forth until that project or the projects are resolved and finished.
Wow. Gosh, thanks you guys for taking the time out to talk to us. Yeah, good luck with the show, and I recommend everyone go check it out. It's at the Clay Center right now. Check it out at claycenter.org, I believe. And thanks again, you guys. Great talking with you. Great to connect.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
ripple in the wind, you could hear it on the rocky shore. So I'm walking and a singing and a praying and a dancing, a whooping and hollering all around. Silence is not for the birds and the trees, not for the ones who act like me. And I'm not gonna rest till the sun goes down. Whistle my heart content in time.
Oh, yeah. What a good interview, Brian. Thank you.
Aw, shucks. Thanks.
So now, guys, this is actually our last chance to really talk about Mountain Fair because next week, Express Yourself is going to be overtaken by an hour-long special Mountain Fair music podcast, which I highly recommend you all tune into. And then the week after, guess what? We'll be banging the drums, 4 p.m. We are exactly 2 weeks from the opening moment of the Carbondale Mountain Fair. Want to remind everyone that tonight in the R2 Gallery, big opening, the history of the Mountain Fair, 50 years of fair. And it spans from the 70s to 2020. It's a phenomenal show. I highly recommend you all get out there and check it out. If you can't come tonight between 6 and 8, we are open Mondays through Saturdays, and it will be hanging all through the month. So now we're going to talk some pie. We have Carly DeBeck and Alta Otto here with us. They are the Pie Mavens. Hi, gals.
Hi.
Hi, Alta, you there?
I think can you hear me?
Yes, we got you.
Okay.
All right. Well, gosh, I mean, pie took a year off last year, so that should have given people plenty of time to perfect their recipes.
Mm. Yeah, that's what we're hoping.
So let's talk what's happening at pie. What's it about for those that don't know?
So for those that don't know, the pie contest is a pie baking contest. And so we have three categories. We have the fruit category, a cream category, and an exotic category. And we have seven judges at each table. And then they move on to the best of show from each table. And then those are judged. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. We have a lot of longtime judges, some guest judges. We have a really great time. We have a great crew.
And if someone wants to participate in the pie baking contest, I'm glad you clarified that because pie eating, Brian was really trying to beef up his pie eating capabilities.
Jeez. Yeah.
Well, we need him to be a judge.
Oh, yeah. Is Brian going to judge?
Wow. If you've got an open slot, I will take it. But I know it is hard to come by, Alta.
We might have an open spot just for you.
You're announcing it on the radio.
He won't be able to, actually, because he has to do the artery cranky at that time, I believe.
He's
a man in demand.
Why?
That's the crazy thing is at the Mountain Fair at 11 a.m., there are so many things going on. People have so many choices. It's wild. But if you want to enter a pie, what do you do?
So you need to enter the contest between 10 and 10:45, and you'll bring your pies to the judging canopy, and we will get you all set up with the name of your pie is also part of the creativity and get it in the right category. And then the judging starts at 11 and typically ends around noon to one, just depending on how many pies each table has to judge.
I thought it depended on how much champagne you drank.
Well, that too.
Well, we have Carly has joined us as well. And I mean, this is awesome. You and Carly are sisters. And you kind of grew up around the fair. Carly, can you kind of tell us how you got involved in the pie contest? And did you go to the fair when you were little?
And I think you're on mute, Carly.
I think you're on mute.
Are you there?
Well, we are
there.
Well, oh, you're cutting out. You may be, you know, Carly lives in Redstone. It's a.
I'm here. I'm sorry. No, I've been to almost.
Uh-oh.
Actually, I don't think that your connection is good. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But we do have Alta can answer that for Carly. Yeah, talk about it.
So, yeah, we've been to, well, I've been to every single fair. She moved away for a little bit and was gone. But the fair has been a huge part of our life growing up in Carbondale. Our mom was a pie judge. So we've been learning the pie and just how coveted it is and how much fun it is since we were little kids running around, running around the fair.
Well, is your mom still a pie judge?
She is still a pie judge.
I know what would happen. I know that when you girls took over, you tried to institute some changes because pie judges, it's really hard, as Brian mentioned, to get to be a pie judge. A lot of the same people have been judging the pies for as long as there has been a pie contest, which I believe, gosh, I should have looked at that timeline. I think it started in 1976 or 77.
Yeah, I think that's something like that, yeah.
Wow, way back in the day.
Yeah, and most of the judges have been judging for a really long time. And when I took over the pie, I asked each judge to sit out a year so that we could bring in newer people. Some people have moved away or passed away, and we have been able to open up and make it not so exclusive and bringing in new people. So that's been really fun.
Why does everyone want to be a pie judge? That's the question I ask. What is it?
It's so much fun. It's I don't even know. We just have such a great time, and there's all different age groups, and you haven't seen those people for so long. It's just fun to get together and hang out and taste pies.
And there is a theme. I know that there's a theme every year. People get dressed up. What's the theme this year?
Shimmery, shiny, gold.
We're speaking for Carly because her connection is not good. And I'm so sorry because Carly is a big part of the pie contest.
Yeah, she actually is the coordinator at this point.
Yeah, because Alta now is coordinating all the vendors for the fair, which is a whole nother big ball.
Yeah, a huge, huge undertaking.
So can you remember any of the names of any of the winners or any pies that you have tasted that just were so crazy good?
So I have a list of like memorable pies. Some of them maybe weren't the best, but we still remember them. Savannah and I were talking about it, and there was a meat pie in 2019 that was from the British baking contest.
Whoa.
That was pretty interesting and pretty delicious. There's been a pie that was made to look like Sopris. That was pretty awesome. There was a tomato pie. So people think pies and they think sweet, but we have had a lot of savory pies too.
That's true. Though if you were in the cream pie category, do you think? A meat cream pie?
I don't know. That probably wouldn't score well. But you never know. You never know.
Well, I have seen some people out there that are working on the recipes right now. Because probably good advice for anyone that wants to enter is that don't just think that you're going to whip out a pie the night before and bring it in. You are up against some really tough competition. So you want to perfect your pie making abilities, correct?
Yes, definitely. Definitely be planning ahead. There, we have some bakers that have been baking for the pie contest for a long time. We have a daughter and a father-daughter duo that compete every year. Yeah. And
I think Judy Harvey's prizes. Coming back this year, too. Yeah. And she's one of the most winningest pie bakers.
Yep.
And we have some of
and
her
we
ribbons.
Have great. You, I mean, you win cash, you get a ribbon.
Yeah.
And fame. Carbondale Mountain Fair Pie Contest fame.
And this year, I did order aprons for the winner with the amazing Mountain Fair poster design on them.
Oh, perfect. And those are, yeah, those are very coveted as well.
We do have in the Mountain Fair history show at the R2 Gallery at the launch pad, you can see some of the ribbons. Mostly you can't see recipes, though. These pie bakers,
nope.
they don't like to share their recipes. It's highly coveted.
No, cute. When Heidi was doing the pie contest years back, she tried to start a cookbook with the pie recipes, and they didn't want to share that.
Yeah, well, I could see why.
Yeah.
In fact, let's talk a little bit. The pie contest was started, I believe, by Jane Hendricks, who is Heidi Hendricks's mom. And Patty Phelan, I believe, was involved. And a woman named Ethel Saunders won the first pie contest. And I believe Ethel was really young and beautiful and hot and well-loved in town, even though the name might suggest, you know, otherwise. But we do have a picture, I think, of Ethel in the history show as well.
I'll have to come check that out.
Oh, you will. You will. I believe your mom's in it quite a few times. And so then what was so interesting, and this is, I think, the magic of the Mountain Fair, is that then it got passed on, right? So I believe that, Susan Burley did. Who did the pie contest in between Jane and when you guys took it over? Oh, maybe Marty Bauer. Did Marty?
It was Marty Bauer. Yep. Yeah. And so when Marty was done, she passed the spatula to me.
and Heidi and Harmony, all the Hendricks girls have helped forever. Brad Hendricks, their father, was a big judge. We have lots of pictures in the show of Brad opening champagne because a benefit of being a judge is you get to drink champagne with your pie tasting. Though I don't want to suggest that this is a frivolous competition, right? It's extremely serious.
It's very serious.
I remember from when I did it a few years ago, when I got lucky enough to be part of it, there was like a whole scorecard, a score sheet, and different ratings you could give for flavor and texture. And being a newbie, I learned a lot. So they really do put a lot of work into it.
Yep, they have to fill out a whole score sheet, the whole scoring system. Yeah. Heidi, it took me 3 or 4 years to really understand the scoring system, but but we got it.
Usually we would sell slices right after. Because of our world today, we're not going to do that, but we will offer the whole rest of the pie to people. Yeah. So, and we hope that people will stop by and buy that because it does help our bottom line on making this fair happen. But you won't be able to get individual slices this year only. In fact, I guess whatever doesn't get sold, we'll just have to come backstage and we'll just have to eat it.
Yeah, and we'll just eat pie there.
That's correct. So real quick, before we go, I want to mention there's also a cake contest on Sunday. Those categories are cake, exotic, and cupcake. And one might say, well, everything's a cake. But the cake, it could be a torte. It could be, you know, well, the torts might be an exotic, and cake is your basic cake. And then you got exotic. Yeah. And then a new category this year is cupcakes. So there you have it. Yeah. And that, too, is at 11 and runs just the way the pie contest does. We have tons of volunteer slots still open. And, folks, that is the magic of the fair. You have to volunteer. We are on second and third generation volunteers. We need to fill these slots or we can't do the fair. And I think there's so many new people in the Roaring Fork Valley in our communities. And it is time for those new people to step up and sign up.
Well, we just—it's
so much fun to volunteer.
Yeah,
we had to. Growing up, that was a requirement. We had to volunteer at some point during the fair.
Hear that, parents? That's a great idea. We had somebody in the office actually that was they're new to town and they're just interested in getting involved. And over the past year, you know, being at home all the time, you might not have met so many people, but this is a great way to meet people, get in the community, meet the your fellow community members. So come out and volunteer. Come and help out.
Exactly, exactly. And you can sign up to volunteer at carbondalearts.com. There's a Mountain Fair tab up there, or you might see these cool QR codes around town, and you just have to hold your phone up to it, and it'll take you right there. Right, Bri?
That's right. Look for the little rainbows.
Look for the little rainbows. We're guaranteed some rainbows over Mountain Fair, which is July 23rd to 25th. And we are here with Alta Otto, who not only runs the pie contest with her sister, Carly DeBeck, but also oversees the vendors. Real quick, how many vendors are we going to see?
You're going to see over 100. We normally have about 170, so we're a little bit less than that, but we have a lot of new vendors. They're going to be spread out through town. It's going to be so fun. We're really excited.
Yeah, and it was a conscious decision to have less vendors because we're trying to spread everything out a little more. We didn't know what the world was going to be like when we were planning this fair. So we're just being cautious. We're trying to make lots of room for everybody. But it is crucial to support our vendors because they are the ones that really help support this fair, their booth fees. So we are going to be a little down in booth fees by making the fair safer and spreading it out. And everyone out there, you can do your part by going shopping. Lots of good stuff to shop for, right?
Yep. We have a lot of the same vendors, a lot of new vendors. It's going to be really fun.
Well, thanks so much for taking time with us, Alta. I can't wait till we're all together in a couple weeks and celebrating and having fun. And I hope everyone gets by the 50 Years of Fair Gallery Show. Opens tonight, 6 to 8, at the Launch Pad in Carbondale and runs throughout the month. Also, the KDNK podcast on the history of the fair. We've interviewed lots of people, including just old timers, newcomers. We really ran the gamut. And that airs. You can stream it on kdnk.org anytime. But every Tuesday, 4 to 4:30, there is episode. And then on the 16th, next Friday, during Express Yourself, there'll be an hour-long music special. And the music is so good at the fair that we need another hour. So 7 p.m. on Sunday night will be the second portion of the music. And then, you guys, it's going to be time to fair. Theme is gold. It's our 50th year. So everyone, get your outfits ready and get ready to celebrate.
Get your gold on, everybody.
All right. Well, thanks so much. We so appreciate it, Alta. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
All right. All right, folks. Well, we're real excited. Coming up next, we have an interview with Dave Watts. He is the founder and drummer of the Motet. They'll be playing the Mountain Fair, so stay tuned. All right. Wow. Well, thanks to Alta and Brian and Carly for joining us today. And now we're going to switch gears. Yesterday, I was lucky enough to talk to Dave Watts. And here's what he has to say. And I'll tell you what, the motet's been around a long time. I think they've played, actually, I thought it was only twice, but they may have played three times already at the fair. Here you go. I am here with Dave Watts from the band Motet, or The Motet, I guess, is the official name. And they are playing Mountain Fair Saturday night, July 24th. This will be, I believe, the third time they've played the fair, but they have been one of the favorites for many, 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 many years, and in all kinds of genres. That's the beauty of the motet. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Amy.
How are you?
Good. It's great to be talking with you.
Yeah. Well, Katie and Kay and the Roaring Fork Valley, as you well know, have always been huge supporters of the motet. And it's exciting. I think the last time maybe the motet played the fair was 2008, I believe.
Wow. Yeah. Your memory is better than mine.
Well, it's because I've been doing a lot of history. I know you played in 2004. That was my first year. Uh-huh. And you were on the slate with Cabaret Diosa. You remember that?
Okay, of course.
Yeah. And then we also, I think you played with Juno What as well? Did you play with Juno What?
Yeah. Of course. Yeah.
And, but we're very excited to have you guys back. Let's talk motet for a little bit. I guess we could go way back. I've known you since your early days out of Boston with Chakra. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's
and
right.
Yeah, you moved to Colorado shortly after that. So that was probably the early mid 90s.
Yeah. I think Chakra's first trip out to Colorado was 91 maybe or 92.
Oh my God.
And then 1994, I think, is when I moved out to Colorado, eventually started the motet.
That's right, in 1998. And let's talk, what, when you originally started the band, and as it progresses through the years, it I feel like the motet is one of those bands that is continually transforming. Members come and go. It would be hard to define the motet as when any one thing, except always at the base of it all is you make people move and groove and just feel the music so well. What was your vision when you started out?
Well, yeah, I think that's my my role, my job as a drummer is to make people move. I never could be a drummer in a, you know, jazz band and have a sitting down audience. You know, it's not satisfying to me. I like to see an audience move and feel that kinetic energy. So, you know, that's at the base of our sort of, you know, concept is to have a dancing audience. But, you know, we love to improvise. We all study jazz and improvisation. So that's also at the core of what we're about. And then, you know, the sky's the limit from there. I think that, you know, through the changes we've had as a band, through the different members and different players we've had in the group, we've just sort of morphed mm-hmm. and, you know, tried many different things, you know. And it's been fun just to mix it up and not just be, like you said, one thing.
Well, as a leader, it feels like you work very collaboratively. So whoever is in the band at the moment, you allow them to bring what they have to it, and that sometimes mm-hmm. informs the direction. Is that correct, would you say?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I would never want to be in a band, you know, like a Prince situation where, you know, the leader is just defining everything absolute. You know, the collaborations that happen are really what's exciting, and there's a lot of mystery there and, you know, possibilities that sort of unfold as they come up, you know, come out, you know, when you work with other people. So it's a lot more interesting to me. And, yeah, we've had so many great musicians that, you know, we've come up with a lot of different kinds of music. It's sort of the the whole is greater than the sum of the parts situation, you know, and puts their energies into the writing process. The things that come out are definitely unexpected and exciting for everybody.
You know, I remember early days of Motet. I guess you were more musical, not really vocal. Vocal wasn't a strong part.
Well, we've gone through different phases, you know.
Yeah.
We've had vocalists, and then we've not had vocalists, and we've had percussionists, not had percussionists, you know, horns, not horns. It all kind of like morphed over time, so.
So now where are you seeing yourself now in this latest transformation?
Our vocalist, Lyle Davinsky, has moved on last year during the COVID experience, and same with one of our horn players. So now we're bringing on different guests for shows. Sometimes we're actually just going out as a five-piece and doing all instrumental. Mm-hmm. But for Carbon Down Mountain Fair, we're actually bringing our friend Jen Hudswick, who's a singer and trumpet player for Trey Anastasio Band.
Oh,
and
wow.
She'll be out with us. She was with us at our Red Rock show just last month. And, man, she's so good. Nobody will be disappointed. She's an amazing singer and trumpet player. Yeah, we're excited to collaborate with her and see what comes out. So we'll have some vocals, and also our keyboard player Joey does talk box, which is always fun.
Oh, great. Oh, that's awesome. I'm very excited. So let's talk about how it is now after a year and a half of not performing, just kind of dead in the tracks there, to what are audiences like now when you're out there playing? I mean, is the energy just over the top?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, we did a show at Red Rocks last month, like I was saying, and it was incredible. People came out in droves. It wasn't full capacity yet, but it felt like it. The energy from the audience, and probably like 6,000 people there, and the energy of the audience was just incredible. So, yeah, getting back to performing, people are so excited, and people are really excited to have masks off and be able to hug each other and dance next to each other and have it be, back to some kind of a normalcy. And it's, man, it's great for us as performers because we just feed off that energy. I mean, Carbondale Mountain Fair, from my memory, has always been one of the most fun shows of the year just because that energy already existed with your little town up there. But I'm sure this year it's going to be crazy.
Well, it is going to be off the hook because it is our 50th anniversary of Mountain Fair.
Oh,
yeah.
Look at that.
Yeah, it's a huge, huge 50. Milestone. That's why we're bringing back some of our favorite bands over the years. Of course, a lot of those bands that played 50 years ago, you know, they don't exist, but we were very excited.
Who was the first band to play Mountain Fair 50 years ago?
I think like they were called the Ginger Cookie Band or something.
They didn't stand the test of time, I guess. Awesome, though. Oh, my God.
Yeah. And I mean, you're a Saturday night band, so the energy will be off the hook, I would imagine. In fact, our motto for this year is from 1 year of social distancing to 50 years of socializing, because that's been really a big part of what the Mountain Fair is about. You know, everyone comes out, and a lot of people that have lived here but go away, they come back. It's a big reunion. People are excited to see each other. And now this year, it's maybe, you know, people, your neighbor, who you might not have seen for a year and a half. It's a whole different meaning of what seeing people means.
Well, we're excited to be part of it.
As a performer, how did you get through the last year and a half?
Well, I mean, leading up to this whole thing, we were just on the road, just grinding. So honestly, having the downtime has been pretty nice. I mean, you know, we all miss playing live, you know, last year. But, as musicians, we find ways of getting creative, expressing ourselves at home. You know, for me personally, being able to have time at home to write and to practice and to do my thing, and we came up with ways to write music remotely as a band, and we did some video projects like that. So it actually was, you know, it was a little distressing to watch, you know, 80 shows or so get canceled. But, you know, we figured out a way to get through it. We had some help, you know, financially from the powers that be. So that got us through just paying rent. And, you know, it actually allowed us to do some writing and to practicing on our own to sort of grow our craft. So I think that, you know, a year out of, you know, off the road is about all we could stand, you know, but the change came at about the right time. So now we're just kind of, the batteries are recharged. We're really pretty excited about performing again.
So are we going to see some of the stuff that you guys wrote and worked on over the last year?
Oh, yeah. We got a bunch of new stuff. And, you know, just the change of lineup has kind of pushed us into some different realms. You know, our saxophonist is playing mostly keyboards now. So that's been a, you know, sort of a sonic change for, you know, our arrangements and stuff. So, yeah, it's been, you know, we're different, but the same.
Mm-hmm.
It's always, for us, that's kind of been our MO.
Yeah. Oh, I agree.
It doesn't freak me out at all.
Yeah. That's what I love about a motet show is you're never sure, you know, you're kind of sure, obviously, when you release an album and you listen to it, that's you're going to see that. But that improvisational part of the motet that's always been there, and then the ability to just be so fluid in your music, always, I think that's the beauty of the motet, and what really connects with your audiences is they expect the unexpected almost. There's no like, oh, it's got to be this or it's got to be that. What they do know is that they are going to be on a musical journey that's going to get their bodies moving and going to make them feel good.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's really something that we try and keep in mind the whole time. You know, we want a dancing audience. We want that cathartic experience for everybody so that you're a different person by the time the show is over. You know, that transformative element to music is a beautiful thing, and I think that, you know, we always want to keep that in mind when we're writing and performing.
Well, I have to say that, you know, for several years now, long before there was the pandemic, it had been my vision to bring back the motet. But of course, our budgets are small, and so I was like, I don't know how I'm going to be able to figure this out or pull this off. And I will say that. Probably the fact that the pandemic was happening and I was able to reach out at a time when, you know, agents and everyone were really receptive to anyone that really wanted to talk about having live music at an event. Ended up helping us. I don't know that I would have been able to get you in a different circumstance because you guys would have been so busy and you know,
it's a blessing in various ways for sure.
Yeah, well, for us at least, for sure. And I we're really, really excited about having you here and kind of celebrating with us all these years of great music and being together. The Mountain Fair, I think, was one of the original hippie fests, I always like to say.
You guys are probably like right there with Oregon Country Fair, maybe.
Exactly. Yeah, we do. You know, I've never been to Oregon Country Fair, but we do get, everyone always says, you've got to go. They're unfortunately like right before they're usually in early July, mid-July, I think, which made it hard for me to get to. But I'm very excited to have you here. We can't wait to hear the direction you're going in and have you part of the celebration of the 50th Mountain Fair. So, Dave, thank you so much for taking your time with us today and for coming on down here in a couple weeks and just helping us get our groove on.
Yeah, Amy, thank you so much. And Yeah, we're so excited. I mean, it's like we're a Colorado band, and this is like such a staple of Colorado that we're super stoked to be able to like be a part of it once again.
Feel it? Can you feel it, folks? 2 weeks. 2 weeks from tonight, we will be all dancing together, smiling, hearing some great live music. I can't wait. Speaking of live music, there will be free concert in Soper's Park this Sunday. I believe it starts at 3. I know Woodbelly is playing a great bluegrass band. It's just all happening. We're all out there. All over the place. That was a little taste of Motet. But before we go, I do want to play a little taste of some of the other music that's going to be playing. Because there's so much good stuff, including a lot of great local bands. But I'm going to play a little, let's play The Reminders. They are a band that I had last year. They just played from Steve's guitars remotely. But now they will get the full experience out of the Carbondale Mountain Fair. The Reminders. Yeah. They play right before the Motet.